From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, oh yes, those open lines, you become part of the program. Here's what's happening. President Trump isn't spelling out his North Korea strategy yet, but it sounds like the rogue nation, which just vowed to continue testing missiles on a weekly basis, won't like it. Speaking exclusively to Fox and Friends, the commander-in-chief hinted at his own growing frustration with dictator Kim Jong-un and indicated he won't appease the tyrant's continued saber-rattling. Asked what would happen if North Korea were to test another missile, as it has vowed to do, Mr. Trump replied, "We'll find out." Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi from Infowars.com to get his reaction to the latest in North Korea. Well, Jerry, how about an update today for us?
Well, George, it certainly sounds like we're headed towards a military confrontation. North Korea is not going to voluntarily drop its nuclear program. I just don't see any way that's going to happen. Kim Jong-un is resolved to continue testing missiles and advancing his nuclear program on an accelerated schedule. And with President Trump sending perhaps as many as three carrier task forces to offshore of North Korea, I don't think there's another solution that's on the cards except for the next time that North Korea tries a missile test, we're going to have a military response.
I think you're right, Jerry. Now, some of the military experts that I've talked to say that a ground offense by us into North Korea would be a disaster. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, I can't imagine that. It's, again, a 1950s nightmare. The idea that we're going to support 30 or 40,000 troops or more in a ground warfare against North Korea is just, you know, to me, insanity. It's also very dangerous if we try to shoot down missiles or if we do a Syria-type Tomahawk attack on North Korea's missile sites if North Korea tries another missile launch, which most certainly they're going to do. I mean, it's very difficult to think that there's going to be a effective or simple military solution to this problem. I mean, you know, it's always, I continually warn that thinking about these crises, when you're contemplating military action, you can always think how well it's going to turn out. You know, we're going to fire a few missiles, and everybody's going to see the light, and North Korea is going to drop their missile program and their nuclear program. I just don't think it's going to happen.
And what about China? They're not going to just sit back and let this happen.
Well, again, China's been pressured by the United States. The meeting, I'm sure, at Mar-a-Lago, where President Trump met with the head of China, there was pressure, and China has shown some signs, for instance, scaling back the coal that's being taken from North Korea and importing now, starting to import U.S. coal. But these are long-term sanction efforts, which are rarely going to produce an immediate result. If President Trump wants an immediate result, namely that North Korea drops its nuclear program, then we're headed towards a very difficult and very hard to figure out in terms of its ultimate consequences, military strategy, and I remain very fearful that it could escalate easily into a regional or global conflict.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Tragedy in Fresno, California. Three people were killed after a man went on a shooting spree in downtown Fresno, California, while shouting, "God is great" in Arabic before he was tackled and taken into custody there. Police are calling it a hate crime. Steve Stevens, the so-called Facebook killer who sparked a multi-state manhunt after he gunned down a Cleveland man at random, killed himself Tuesday morning in Erie County as the cops closed in. More and more Americans than ever before are stressed, depressed, and anxiety-ridden, and many are unable to get the help they need, according to a new study. I thought we'd check in with the expert on the human mind, Howard Bloom, to get his take on why people are depressed these days. Howard, it is true. I'm seeing it all over the place.
And I have seen it in my own life, and I've watched a bit of it develop in you. And here's how it works. At least this is how it's working over the last 2 weeks. Give a lab rat or a dog a series of punishments that it can't predict, and that it can't control, and the poor animal will go into depression. Yes, unpredictability and lack of control produce depression. Now, worse, unpredictability and lack of control will make your lab animal lose hair, grow skin sores, and stomach ulcers, and will send its immune system and its brain power into a nosedive. Now, right now, North Korea's pudgy little dictator, Kim Jong-un, who you've just been discussing with Jerry, is successfully giving us the sense of a possible World War III, and it's a world war that we can't predict, and a world war whose start we can't control. First off, Kim Jong-un and his propaganda outlets have told us that if we fire one bullet at North Korea, just one, and if we make a single move that hints that we are about to attack, North Korea will obliterate us with nuclear weapons. And you got that word right, obliterate. So where does that leave you and me? A headline in the Atlantic magazine today puts it, Americans can't do much about North Korea. When you can't do much about imminent catastrophe, you get depressed. The Trump administration is not helping. On Monday, Vice President Mike Pence was in South Korea. He said that American military strikes in Syria and Afghanistan showed that President Donald Trump's resolve should not be questioned. But frankly, we don't know if we did any serious damage with our 59 Tomahawk missiles striking the Shayrat Air Base in Syria. ABC reported that two planes took off from that base on a bombing mission just a few hours after our attack. And we don't know if we really did serious harm with our mother of all bombs in Afghanistan. What's worse, after we, the Americans, set off our mother of all bombs and reportedly collapsed an ISIS tunnel complex, killing between 36 and 92 ISIS soldiers, the Russians let the world know that they had the father of all bombs, a bomb reportedly four times more powerful than our monster MOAB. So Vladimir Putin may have won the mine is bigger than yours this competition. Then Donald Trump warned that we are sending an armada, very powerful, to the North Korean region. In fact, it turned out the aircraft carrier at the heart of that powerful armada, the Carl Vinson, was a week away from Korea in the Indian Ocean and was headed in the opposite direction from the Korean Peninsula. What in the world went wrong? General Mad Dog Mattis has a lot of war experience, but the orders for the Vinson to sail full steam ahead for North Korea had been muffed. The orders had not gotten to the aircraft carrier. Now, incompetence like this loses wars. Missteps like this lose wars. They don't intimidate the enemy. They make the enemy laugh. And Kim Jong-un did one more little depressing thing. He appeared to show over the weekend that he could pack roughly 1.8 million civilians into bomb shelters in just one city, his capital city, Pyongyang, in case of a nuclear attack. How many civilians could we shield in bomb shelters? Report out Tuesday morning said zero, none. No wonder we feel insecure, depressed, and just a tiny bit terrified.
Gee, Howard, nice talking to you tonight. Thanks a lot, Howard Bloom. Now, how many of us would do what this guy in Ohio did? An Ohio man says he was trying to set a good example for his children when he turned in $14,000 that he found in a bag on the side of a road. Jake Bowers found the money as he drove his family to a park in Worthington, a Columbus suburb. Bowers said when he initially saw the bag on the roadside, he thought it might contain someone's laptop. Instead, it was filled with $100 bills. He went straight to the police department, returned it, and the owner showed up. A police report says the owner had taken the cash to a car dealer, but left without buying the vehicle. He told police, gosh, I must have left it on the top of my car when I had driven off. Wow. But turn it in. The guy turned it in, and I find that to be fantastic. Egyptian archaeologists have discovered eight mummies in a 3,500-year-old tomb near the southern city of Luxor. The tomb, discovered near the famed Valley of the Kings, also contained colorful wooden coffins and more than 1,000 statues. That's fantastic. Hey, when you have time, get up to our website. You should do this every day, coasttocoastam.com, and look at all the story events, the highlight reels, and all the information that Lex and his team put together all the time at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, the Rocket Man joins us, David Adair, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. David Adair is an internationally recognized leader, expert in the field of space technology, spin-off applications for industry and commercial use. He has worked as a research scientist in the fields of engineering, jet engine technology, rocket science, and nuclear physics. At age 11, David built his first rocket. At 17, he won the most outstanding in the field of engineering sciences from the U.S. Air Force. At 19, he designed and fabricated a state-of-the-art mechanical system for changing jet turbine engines for the U.S. Navy. Just an amazing career. And he likes my shirts at live events. Hey, David, welcome.
Thanks, George. And I do like your shirts. You got great taste.
But those events are fun. I get a kick out of doing that. You had a great time out there, too, at that AlienCon in San Francisco.
Ed, and I was amazed how well you sing.
It's kind of a surprise, isn't it?
It is. I mean that respectfully. But, yeah, you know, most people, I guess, are waiting to hear fingernails on a chalkboard. But not with you, buddy. You're pretty smooth.
Hey, David, before we get into all the great things you've been working on, and we're going to talk about the moon, I want to go back a little bit for our brand-new listeners and have you talk to them a little bit. You were basically grabbed by the military because of your knowledge at a very young age to help them develop rocket technology, and then you realized this technology is going to be used in a very aggressive way, and you kind of pulled back. Tell us what happened.
Well, I had been building rockets for years as a child, and they started getting bigger and more advanced. But what really kicked everything into gear was my mother. She was the a LPN, and she had a patient named Irving LeMay, and the wife, Arizona LeMay, was there. He was like 92 or 93, and she was a coronary care technician. In 1966, she was like one of the first females to do that in the state of Ohio, and this is a brand new facility, had state of the art. But they had a son named Curtis, and this is a 4-star General Curtis LeMay of the Air Force, the designer of the B-52 Stratofortress. He was chief of the Joint Chiefs. He founded SAC, Strategic Air Command. He was just a huge item back then. He was the guy that told North Korea, if you don't come to the Paris Peace Talks, I'll bomb you back into the Stone Age. And him and Robert McNamara went at it over that. But a very powerful, very famous person. So he'd like to come and see his parents at 2 or 3 in the morning. My mother was in charge of the graveyard shift from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. So he'd show up about 3 or 4 in the morning and see his parents without having the paparazzi all over him. And over the course of time, he got to know my mother pretty well, and he asked how her sons are doing. She goes, well, the older two are fine. The third one's a little odd. He's constantly launching these massive rockets, and that caught LeMay's attention. You mean little bottle rockets? No, but she showed a picture she brought with her, and there's one about, I guess, 10 or 12 feet tall, weighs about 1,000 pounds, and he's going, holy cow. So he listened to her and he asked, does he keep a notebook around? Does he write stuff down all the time? He's got this one notebook that's about 93 pages in it. So I go to bed before 11 to go to school the next day.
Yeah.
So my mother grabs the notebook and don't tell me. She takes it up and he looks at it, and he's not a dumb man. He's reading through it. And then he just turned to my mother and asked very shyly, do you have a copier? A copy's about a third of this book.
I think
he didn't copy the whole thing. And he took off with it, and he went about an hour and a half by car way from our town to Columbus, and he took it to a place called Battelle Memorial. And if you know about that place, it's a big think tank. I think back in 1970, they had like 130 Nobel laureates on their staff. It's just very powerful.
Well-educated place.
Oh, yeah, and so heavy into government contracts. It and RAN, they run all the show. So anyway, which, by the way, Battelle Memorial, you have to do some digging, but you'll find out that they maintain labs and labs facilities and research facilities. And guess who's on their list? Area 51.
There it is.
Yeah, the Battelle Memorial is the management of that thing. So anyway, LeMay shows some people the notes, and they asked, where's this person? And they said, don't know. He's out there in cattle fields launching rockets all over the place.
And he's a kid.
Yeah, and he's like, at that time, he was 15. They go, my God. So LeMay asks, well, what's up with the math notes? Or is it just scribble or something? No, it's real. And he's heading, he's working on fusion containment. He said, you know, fusion, this is 1966. And so a lot of people didn't know exactly what fusion containment was.
Right.
And he said, you're kidding. He said, no, we sure like to meet him. And so I did. I met with him at Ohio State, which is right across the street from Battelle Memorial. So they came over there, and I met with him. And then LeMay, after listening to me talk to him and answer questions and all this stuff, yeah, I guess he had a talk with that staff. And then the next thing, I got a knock on the door at my house and opened the door, and there stands Colonel Arthur Bailey Williams, a full-bird colonel. He is the XO of General LeMay. And this is January 6, 1969. If you remember, LeMay ran for president. He ran for vice president.
That's right, he tried.
It was George Wallace. And, of course, he got shot, and they didn't win the election. So LeMay is, that's in November 68. So 1 month later, I get a knock on the front door. And what I find out later, LeMay is changing gears. He wants to do something else. And so he starts this project where he asked me, if you could have everything in the world you need, materials, equipment, people, everything, where do you want to go with this? And I said, well, I'm trying to get a containment on a nuclear power plant. A new type of nuclear power plant is fusion containment.
Where did you get this knowledge at that age, David? I mean, did you self-taught, or where did it come from?
Well, I was born in number 10 district, Pocahontas Coal Fields in Welch, West Virginia. I was born 3 miles from Coalwood, which is where Homer Hickman, the guy of October Sky movie.
Yeah.
We were born 3 miles from each other. And
it's in the water.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Homer told me that must be something in water back there. But there was a librarian, and she's an elderly lady, and she saw me standing in the corner, and I was sitting on the floor in the corner. I had all these books stacked in front of me, and she goes, you come in here every day for months. Are you reading these books? And I said, well, there's no pictures in them. And I
was, that's right.
I wasn't trying to be smart. And she just said, you understand this stuff? And I said, yeah. She said, you only come in and go to this corner, nowhere else in the library. I said, well, this is what I want to read. And so she grabs a book off the shelf, and she shows me the title of it. And she opens it up, and she goes, now you tell me what this book is talking about. And actually what it was fundamentals of graviton fuels for black holes.
And you had already read it, I'm sure.
I did, and I told her exactly how it was happening in class, the collapse of a dying star. Supergravity envelops it, keeps imploding, you know, until it gets so small you can't even see it, and it still weighs as much as it did when it was half a million miles in diameter. So the gravity fields go into an area of quantum physics, which is difficult for regular physicists to work with. And anyway, I said, the thing turns into a singularity with an event horizon. And she's looking through it and looking at some diagrams in there, and she said, oh, my God, you remember all this. I said, when did you read this book? I said, I read that particular book about 7 months ago. She said, well, how many of these books have you read? I said, in this section of hard science, I said, every single one of them.
Jeez. You were a boy genius, David.
No, I don't know. I'm just a yahoo born in West Virginia. I mean, it was but they, it was about 600 books, and she looked at them, and she said, my God, would you like to? She goes, why are you reading them again? I said, well, I have this notepad. She goes, yeah. Well, I'm correcting the mistakes in the books, and I'm going to write it to the publishers.
To the publishers.
Yeah, I said, they're wrong. They're wrong on these conclusions. And she's looking at me, you're correcting the science books. And the author said, yeah, I thought they might like to know where they made a mistake. Well, being a kid, you know, adults don't want to hear that stuff. But she said, Listen, if I can get you all the books you want in these subject areas, you got to promise me you won't tell anybody because she'll be using her resources for one single little kid.
Hold that story right there, David. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back in a moment with the Rocket Man, David Adair, to talk about his incredible life. And also we'll talk about some of the things he's working on now in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Adair with us, the Rocket Man. We're talking about his story, then we're going to get into his work about the moon. So, David, you're in the library. The librarian is buying and ordering books for you. You're 15 years old. The government wants to tap into your brain. Did you ever meet Wernher von Braun by any chance?
Yes, a couple of times. It was really a cool meeting. I was staying at the Cape Canaveral Hilton for the Apollo 11 launch, and I had a really nice seat provided by Congressman John Ashbrook, and I got to sit right next to him. I was about 6 or 7 feet from Walter Cronkite, so wherever he was sitting, I was just a few feet away from him, and it's a long story. It's layered upon layers, but
yeah.
Circumstances happened, and I ended up meeting von Braun at a social gathering at the Hilton.
And you're 15.
I'm 15, and I'll drop stuff. And it sounds so incredulous unless you get all the details, and it makes total sense. But I ended up with the penthouse suite with Marilyn Hilton had gave me, and so. Everybody was in cramped quarters. Cronkite was stuck in just a single bedroom and all his equipment, so he could barely move around. And I had this huge spread on top and the buildings. And so von Braun was asking, "Who's up there?" And I said, "I'm staying there." And he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "It's a long story." And he said, "Well, I'd like to hear it." So we had a place. We left together. We went across the courtyard.
Did you know who he was at that time?
Absolutely. Okay. And what got him his attention was I was introduced to him by this other lady, and he turns around, and the first thing I asked him, I said, "What was life like at Pina Monday?" And he was, "Wow, you know about that?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "It was difficult." "Yeah, from what I understand, Metalworks was a really hard place to work. A lot of people died." He goes, "Well, you're well informed for somebody so young." And I said, "Well, it's this tight community, everybody talks." So he said, "Do you work on rockets or is aerospace stuff?" I said, "Yeah, rockets. I'm working on I'm using a rocket engine right now as a medium to test theorems on the possibility of closing a containment field on a nuclear fusion containment power plant."
Oh, man, his mind must have been going a mile a minute when he heard you say that.
And what stuff he had in his hand, he just, waiters walked by and just dropped it all right on the platter. He said, "Can we see your room?" I said, "Sure." And so we walked across the courtyard and went up into this huge suite I had. It was Maryland's. It was so pretty. And he said, "You're doing pretty good for yourself." I said, "Yeah." I said, "It's a long story how I got
now, were you getting paid at all from the government at this point, David?
No. Actually, I was being paid by Vern Estes.
Oh, yeah, the Rocket Man in Denver,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Penrose, Colorado.
That's right. He had that company that made those rocket engines and little toy rockets.
Yeah, he had just started, and I flew some of his rockets, and I wrote a letter to him and said, "You need to change this and this and this on it."
Oh, that's something.
And he wrote back, he said, "Could you do that, or could you look at every rocket I got and write me a page on it?" I said, "Sure." So in a few weeks, this huge box showed up, and I got everything in his catalog.
I used to order those as a kid. I loved them.
Well, imagine getting like 500 engines.
I know. Those solid propellant engines. I'll tell you a quick funny story, David, then we'll get back to yours. But when I used to make these engines and rockets from Estes, I would make the rocket, and I would be the broadcaster to all the kids in the neighborhood when we launched it. And my buddy, Gary Frank, would be the one to put the little ignition electrodes and hook it up to the battery clips, and then off it would go. So I would count down the launch to the neighborhood, and Gary would be the engine guy. Well, I ended up going into broadcasting. Gary helped make the engines of the space shuttle.
You came for destiny to go.
Yeah, well, it's a funny story. And so the same thing happened with you.
Yeah, I didn't have the heart to tell Vern that what I was using his rockets for. I was using them for wind drifts so I could check the various altitudes at different levels of what the upper winds were doing for my rockets. And my rockets were huge, and the average altitude on each flight was over 50,000 feet.
Wow. Now, what did you make yours with?
Well,
the body.
These are cryogenic pumpers. I had cryogenic fluids, which takes, you got to have special handling device and stuff. So.
But like aluminum for the casing of the rocket? Or?
Yeah, well, you got to have all the insulated bottles, and you have to have a lot of, everything's got to be insulated because you're dealing with around 325 degrees below zero. And but that's also when you got that kind of volatile state of a liquid, tremendous power and thrust can be gained out of it. So that's what I was using it for. But the rockets were moving along pretty good, and that's what I was using them for. I was just trying to get an idea of what kind of rocket I would need to build that could give me a single burst of speed in a fusion containment environment, and that's what I finally worked out. And, you know, people who think they know so much, like Stanton Friedman said, that engine could never work. You can't fly in Earth. And
I said, I love Stan. Well, he was just on with me last week.
Really? Somebody asked me that, and I said, he's absolutely right. This engine isn't made for that kind of use, but for an experiment, it's going to do just fine, and I'm only going to do a controlled burst detonation. And it's very simple. You just blow up a balloon and let go, and it flies around in the room, you know, and the air coming out the nozzles, pushing on the front of the balloon. That's what makes it move. Well, I just used an extremely simple principle. It was a... It was Occam Razor is what it was. I thought, what's the easiest solution to this problem for a containment field? I can't have cyclotrons and all this stuff tangled up in rockets. And that's when it hit me and said, a rocket, just open up one of the fields on one of the detonator chambers and I'll get propulsion. And that way I know if the containment fields will hold. And so that's why I started in that direction. And then about that time, that's when... Colonel Williams shows up, and we start. It takes us 26 and a half months every day, and we finally get the thing built. And it's built throughout an elaborate module process. We send all the parts to all the different groups we're working with, and LeMay's, you know, just, God, they could pick up the phone and make anything happen. Anyway, I had people like Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Los Alamosos, National Laboratories,
you had them all.
Memorial. It's just so many of them. And so there was hundreds of people involved in this project. I wasn't doing it by myself. But I was the one that only knew how all the parts go together. So they get these parts, and we couldn't tell them what we were putting it in. So they, you know, just mail it out to the specs that we sent. And then I did final assembly at the big garage that we had, and we got the thing put together, and then off we went to Wright Patterson Air Force Base, and there was a waiting C-141 Starlifter, and the rocket fit in there, got us a big plane, and then we took off to White Sands, New Mexico. We got there, and I always force myself to remind everybody, you know, the credibility, we're going so fast in the story, there's so many characters involved.
At what point, though, David, did you decide you weren't going to do this anymore because you felt they were going to use your rockets for military applications?
That was after I got to Area 51. Then we went down underground to their underground facility, which is where everything was. It's huge, and they brought me there for a reason. What happened, a guy showed up back at White Sands, who took over the entire project, locked up Colonel Williams, and this guy was a guy named Arthur Rudolph, who was the chief architect of the F-1 Saturn V engines of Apollo. He also came over in Operation Paperclip. He was from Peenemunde, and he was a really, really
Did they come after you when you decided you wanted out?
Well, yeah. After I learned downstairs, they finally told me why they brought me there. They wanted to show me this electromagnetic fusion containment engine, which was, mine was about the size of a really big watermelon, but theirs was the size of an 18-wheel semi with a tractor. I mean, this thing was 70 feet long, 22 feet wide, and about 15 feet tall. I mean, it was just huge. And it didn't take me long to figure out, stand there and listen to them, talk to me, you know, ask them. They brought me here to help them figure out how this thing works. I said, well, I thought you all said it was your engine. Well, it is. The people's working on it on vacation. You're on vacation, son. Well, they're on vacation, too, summer vacation. I said, did they leave any notes so I could read on it? And they said, well, you have homework, son. They took their notes with them. And I said, oh, God, this guy's lying through his teeth. And so anyway, after we got through down there, we went back upstairs, and I could hear them talking, and they said, if this kid didn't help us unravel this thing, we're not going to get first strike speeds. And I'm sitting there going, what is it, baseball? What's first strike? This is 1971. No one's ever heard of first strike. It's not in the English language of average people. And so I kept listening to them talk, and finally I realized they were talking about total commitment. And then I thought, well, man, they're talking about global thermonuclear war. Oh, they're trying to win mad. Mutual assured destruction, that's what we live under, MAD. And the only way to win mad is you strike so fast, first strike, that they can't retaliate and you win mad, which is just insane proposition. But that's when I realized they're trying to pervert my speed of this rocket to a first strike weapon. And I thought, man, that is not what. I'm trying to build a power plant. I'm not trying to build a first strike weapon, but they. It's going to fit perfectly in their plans if I don't do something about it. So I had to destroy my engine up on the desert floor.
David, what do you think of the North Koreans and what they're doing with their missiles? I mean,
it's just pure aggression. To what end are they doing this? You know, a satellite or a space shuttle used to go over Korea at night. North Korea is completely dark. They don't have electricity anywhere in the country, except in the big capitals. So it's very difficult for people to live there. Imagine being in the dark all the time at night. So they're desperate. They're desperate for everything. Now, what I see it as is acts of desperation. And that's when it's dangerous. When a person gets desperate, like this little guy is, they're going to do stupid stuff. And you got somebody like Trump that is short fuse, quick to respond. That's a combination for a disaster. You're gonna have some kind of nuclear confrontation before this thing's over with. And it's gonna be ugly. It's gonna be nasty. It's gonna be bad news for South Korea and China.
Oh yeah, and everybody
in Japan, especially Japan. They're all downwind of this stuff.
Well, what about Hawaii?
Hawaii's definitely in range of these. I know this rocket personally. This rocket is more than capable of making it to Hawaii with no trouble. It will also be fairly accurate, so if they wanted to hit a good, you know, right into the main city of Hawaii, they can do so. And there's about a million population on the island combined.
All of them, yeah.
It's going to be a bad situation. But look at the history of this. It's amazing. The only state in the Union that got attacked was Pearl Harbor.
That's right. And here it goes again.
And here it goes again with the nuclear weapon that we used at the end of that war.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
It sure is.
You can't make this stuff up.
What's going on, you know, because you're in the know, David. What's the military doing right now? What are they planning?
Well, right now what they would be doing is they're working on intel nonstop. So they're trying to get an idea of what's going on in Korea. And see how much they are. And there's been military action. I don't know if you saw the 150,000 Chinese troops.
Yeah, along the border there, sure.
Yeah, I think they're doing that to keep people from running into China.
Well, that's what they say, but
I think they're getting ready. I think they worked out a deal, the Chinese president and Trump, and I think they're executing it right in front of us. put those guys on the border, move in the fleets. When you move in as much fleets as he has, you're getting ready to do some serious military action. You're going to bomb the daylight out of something.
And the Chinese are not too happy with Kim Jong-un in North Korea.
No, they've already turned the coal over and supported Bush, Trump, who has really pushed nothing but coal, so which is really a bad mistake. But anyway, they're pushing coal, and the Chinese people like it. And so they're obviously working out some kind of deal. And it's going to be bad news. It's not guaranteed.
It's not good.
This deal is going to be a short stick for North Korea.
David Adair with us. His website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And the next hour, we'll talk to David about the moon and some fascinating things there. And we'll take your calls as well. David, what are you working on these days? What's your current project?
Well, the current thing right now, I've just finished it up out there in the lab. It's called the Gamma Ray Creation Project. And it's an offshoot of some I was working with Northwestern University, of all things, their in vitro machine. In that system, you have a rack of eggs, and you need to see which eggs are the strongest. And the way they do that, they watch the sperm enter the egg, and when the sperm enters the egg, it causes the zinc to ignite, and when it does on the eggshell surface, and then that zinc sticks to molecules, and you get this flash. So the eggs that flash the brightest are the strongest eggs to work with, and half the tree don't even flash, so there's a dead egg. And I was helping on the camera end, where it's a microscopic camera. You can actually see the flash when the sperm enters the egg, so it's like flash of creation. And everybody thought that was cool. So I was through with that part, and I said, I'm going to go now, but I'm going to take this work, and I'm going to go another step further. And I told him what I was going to do, and he said, where did you get that idea? I said, it just came in a dream, man. But what I've done is I've taken the in vitro machine with the cameras, and now I've put it inside a cloud chamber. Now, you've seen cloud chambers. They're filled with anything from alcohol vapors to even antifreeze vapors.
Right.
And you get this vapor in this chamber, and what happens, you see all these streaks going through, and there's nothing around it. It's just a big plexiglass box sitting there in the middle of the room. And these streaks just keep going in all directions. So where are they coming from? Well, they're coming from the roof of the building. It's a gamma ray particle, and it goes through this cloud chamber, so you can see its little vapor trail as it went through the gas. I'm sitting there thinking one
day. Hold on, David. We're already at the top of the hour. Let's come back. We'll talk more about your work. We'll talk about your thoughts about the moon. It's fascinating. And we'll take some phone calls in our final hour next with David Adair on Coast to Coast AM.